ask for your attention and your mindfulness tonight, your tsumet lev. We've been meditating for many days now, practicing various tools. I trust you are aware that these tools properly deserve maybe more space than we can give them within the course of the 10-day duration of our retreat. I am, like many teachers, I have a little problem, and the little problem consists, if I only give you a one method and something that is pragmatic and down-to-earth and solid, then you can practice that and it may produce very good results, but it's only a little bit of what the Buddha was teaching. If I try to give you as much of what the Buddha was teaching, this may be confusing, or it may be too much, or not all of it is going to be useful to you, because all of you are different. All of you are in different stages of practice, you have different backgrounds, you have different needs. So I am not the expert in this, you have to be conscious. I am somebody who practices, I am a disciple of the Buddha, and I try to share with you as honestly and as clearly as I can what helps me, what I believe is useful, what I believe the Buddha has taught. How much of this and what exactly of this is for you right now, you will have to be the expert. I depend on people who are intelligent. I don't want you to believe. If you believe, even if I am right, is not going to be very, very useful, because even if I am right and you believe me, it doesn't really help. What it needs for it to be helpful is that you verify that. Yeah. Verification, Hebrew?
Le'amet.
Okay, you've heard it?
Le'amet.
Le'amet, okay? This is the thing. This is what makes Buddhism Buddhism. Le'amet, okay? This is hard, pragmatic, spiritual science. Yeah? And le'amet is indispensable for that. So don't believe me. Do the le'amet number, okay? So tonight I was thinking of giving you a proper Buddhist discourse, yeah? After I've talked to you about meditation, I'd like to speak about Buddhism tonight. Well, forgive me. We need to fix that first. Good, we're back in action. So I was speaking, would like to speak about a particular branch of teaching which the Buddha called the elephant's footprint. The elephant's footprint, you know, the elephant has a big foot, and it is said that the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, or the Four Ennobling Truths, which is probably a better translation, in its size and in its role in the Buddhist teaching, is like the elephant footprint in comparison to all other footprints of animals. Like all other animals with their footprints can be put into the size of an elephant's footprint, all other of the Buddhist teachings can be put into the framework of the Four Noble Truths. So the Four Noble Truths are probably the most generic expression of the Buddhist teaching, if you want to say so. And you have to imagine Buddhist teachings are kind of like aerial photography. You know, sometimes some of the photographs, if you do cartography, or at least if you used to, nowadays you just go to Google Earth, you make photographs of the Earth, yeah, and the plane flies low, and then you make photographs, the plane flies a little bit higher, and then the plane flies very high, and then you rely for the last bit on satellite photography. That's how it used to be in the old days. Nowadays, cameras are getting better, satellites are getting more. But you have different layers. Yeah. So the Buddhist teaching comes with some aspects of the teaching are very small. Yeah, they come from very low-flying airplanes. So you have very high details. So the teachings on meditation, for example, are very much in detail. Or the teachings on dependent arising, on paticca-samuppada, they're from kind of very low-flying planes. Yeah, you have very detailed pictures. You get very small bits of reality. Yeah, and then there are teachings that come from very high up. So they're very kind of generic. So the teaching of the Four Noble Truths is a very generic teaching. It's a high altitude kind of teaching. Yeah? If you have understood the Four Noble Truths, you're awakened, you're free, you're liberated, you're an arahat. So don't think Four Noble Truths is beginner's Buddhism. Yeah? It's not beginner's Buddhism. It's a profound pattern how the Buddha understood and applied his teaching to the human condition. There is, very early on in Buddhist tradition, you find that the monks are referred to the Buddha as a doctor, as a medicine man, as a surgeon, as a healer. Yeah? You keep having these images that both the Buddha speaks of himself as of a surgeon or a doctor, and some of the monks refer to him as a healer. And that image goes through all Buddhist traditions. You have it in very early Mahayana Buddhism. You have Baisaja Guru, yeah, medicine, the teacher as the medicine man. And then you have it in Tibetan Buddhism as Sanjay Menla, the big medicine Buddha. So you have very early on, you could say, the Buddha is something like the archetype of the therapist or the healer or the doctor. And he applies his Four Noble Truths. Maybe this does not come as a surprise, very much like a doctor. So there is a pattern which occurs in Indian teaching. Those parts I am familiar with, outside of the Buddhist teaching, also use that pattern. And the pattern is very simple. It states, the First Noble Truth is called Dukkha, that they're simple suffering, yeah, as the English translation, is a perspective on the simple fact that there is pain, that there is something not okay. It looks at the phenomenon of suffering. It looks at the fact that there is something that is not okay, that hurts, that is frustrating, that is painful, that is filled with the experience of insufficiency, and that is filled with the experience of loss. And this could be compared with the anamnesis of a patient. You go there and you find out what are the symptoms of suffering. You know, what's the story of his suffering? The second truth is a more detailed look at what are the causes of suffering. Buddhist teaching, I'll go into it in a moment, it's a simple look at where does the suffering depend on? What does it depend on? Where does it come from? What is indispensable for this suffering to arise? In the third perspective, the third of the Noble Truths, is a prognosis. It looks at, does the suffering, can it be cured? Yeah. So you have an anamnesis, you have a diagnosis, you have a prognosis, and the fourth of the Noble Truth of the path leading out of suffering, is the therapy. Yeah. It's the actual therapeutic prescription. It's the medicine. It's the application of a particular curative technique. Yeah. So you have anamnesis, diagnosis, prognosis, and you have therapy. These are not Buddhist inventions. Yeah, this approach has been used by doctors in India, probably before the Buddha. We have texts which speak of the Brahminical tradition of a very similar pattern. If we translate the Arya Satya, the Four Noble Truths, or the Chattu Arya Satya, as it's properly called, as Four Noble Truths, this sounds slightly misleading. It sounds like there are four things that are truthful and they are so noble that we absolutely need to believe them. And if the closer we look at this teaching of the Four Noble Truths, it's actually not something we need to believe. To be very specific, the teaching doesn't actually turn out to be as much a teaching as it is an approach. Yeah. It is a method of approaching an aspect of our experience called suffering. Think of it being as a key. Yeah, if you're in prison and somebody gives you a key. I mean, you're in the inside of the prison, not on the outside. In the inside of the prison, and then somebody kind of slips you the key. Yeah. And if you think of this key being the liberating truth, you can do various things with that key. One way would be to be very grateful that key has come into you. And then you take it, you hang it on the wall, you worship, you bow to it, you pray to it every evening before you go to sleep. You make it very, very clear in your mind. Every morning, this is the first thing you see in your life. You're very grateful and you're very devoted. And you don't go out of the prison with that. Yeah. This does not call for devotion, the teaching of the Four Noble Truths. It calls for application. So what you want is to recognize, hey, this is the key to my prison door. Wow, I wonder whether it works from inside. Yeah, you try it out, and lo and behold, it does work. You know, a creaky sound, you hold your breath, you push open the door, and there you go. Yeah, but it takes you to pick up the key, to try it out, to fit it into the lock, to turn, to push the door, and to open that door. Yeah. So this is what the Buddha wishes us to do with his four ennobling truths. They are ennobling not because they're so sacrosanct that they cannot be anything else but holy. They are ennobling because they make us free. They are the tools that help us to gain freedom in this world. So this is important that you understand it and that you don't get scared when you hear Four Noble Truths. This is what Buddhists believe. Yeah. The truth is, Buddhists believe all kinds of things. If you ask different Buddhists, they believe all kinds of things. But one of the interesting things about Buddhists is they don't believe that believing is such an important thing. Yeah? They do believe it doesn't really matter that much what you believe. It matters a lot more what you investigate, what you do, how you relate to it. Yeah. That's what they believe, really, if you ask me. If you ask other Buddhists, they may have other opinions. This one here believes that. So, we have a pattern of how to practice with these Four Noble Truths, which is paralleling a profound understanding of the phenomenon of suffering, which is trying to track the phenomenon of suffering to some condition, some cause, some support from which that suffering arises. We have a prognosis which says, you know, can this be helped? Should this be helped? Do I want this to be helped? And we have a practical path to actually go about the procedure of help. Yeah? That's a very sort of plebeian, a very sort of, what's the cheapest shopping? What's the cheapest shop chain? This is the Rami Levy version of the Four Noble Truths, okay? Okay. There's another little story. An English monk who is dead already quite a number of years, who was a very smart guy, and who I have never met, but I have read a book of his that was published posthumously. His name is Jnanavira Thera. I would be surprised if many of you know him. And he said, the Four Noble Truths resemble the bottle that Alice in Wonderland has found. You know? Alice in Wonderland forgot where it is through the looking glass, or forgot where it is exactly, has found a bottle. And the bottle doesn't say what it contains, but it says what you should do with it. And on the label it says, drink me. You know? So if you want to have the four bottle version of the Four Noble Truths, yeah, then you would say the first noble truth, the truth of suffering, says, understand me. Yeah, that's what it says. It doesn't say suffering, it says just understand me. Yeah. The second noble truth, on the label it would say, give me up. Yeah, that's the cause of suffering. Generally, it's one form of desire. I will say something about them in a moment. So the second noble truth on the bottle, it says, give me up, you know, abandon me. The third noble truth on the label, it would say, realize me, you know, make me real, make me manifest me. You know, that's the truth of the way that there is a cessation of suffering, that suffering can be given up, that suffering can be cured. So it says, do me, realize me. The fourth noble truth, on the label it says, practice me, develop me, cultivate me. Now, these four versions, they don't come from Alice in Wonderland, just to be clear. It's just that Alice finds a bottle, and on that bottle it says, in an imperative voice. What's an imperative in Hebrew language? Tzivui, okay. Tzivui is an important part here. It's imperative. It's something that appeals to you to do. Not to believe, not to worship, not to venerate, but to do. Yeah. We become other human beings, not by believing, or by hoping, or by praying. We become other human beings by doing things. That's why you're here. That's why I keep asking you to put in effort to be here, to be on time, to be present, to go back to the breath, to ask question if it's not clear, to hold it, to bear it if it's hard, to come back if it was painful, to not run away. Yeah? That's why I keep asking you to do these things, because it's the doing that transforms us. It's our willingness to apply energy, to apply effort. In fact, that's very much what the Buddha called meditation or practice. He called it yoga, anu-yoga. Yeah? The word yoga, which nowadays means hatha yoga postures, in the days of the Buddha was not hatha yoga postures. You know. Most of the hatha yoga postures haven't been invented before the 16th century, as probably some of you will know. The yoga the Buddha was speaking for was an application of one's energies to a spiritual practice. And the word comes is a cognate of the English word yoke, or the French word joug, or the German word joch. It's
all.
It's the thing you hang over the ox, yeah? Or two oxen. Namely, that you stop them from lateral movement, and because they can't run away laterally, they can go a little longer in a straight line. Yeah? That's the idea. Limitation of movement to the side, but more energy for moving straight ahead. You can apply that to marriage, to business, to spiritual practice. It's very simple. Yeah? It's a voluntary, in the case of the oxen, it wasn't voluntary, but in the case of spiritual practice, it is voluntary. Limitation of scattering energies laterally, but with the wish to proceed more strongly and more decisively forward. So that's where the concept of practice comes from. So yoking is an interesting term. It means applying energy. This is crucial for spiritual practice. There are spiritual teachers, even nowadays, very popular ones, that do denigrate the notion of effort. Let's say, you know, if it's really going to make you free, it should be all natural. Yeah. You shouldn't make an effort because all effort is self-centered. You can't produce effort unless you're actually having a notion of self. If I understand the Buddha correctly, this is not accurate. Effort is indispensable. Some things are natural and they're not easy. I'm a man, so I can't really tell from experience, but I'm told birth is a very natural procedure. Yeah? And yet, sometimes it seems to take effort, so as far as I know. Yeah? So not all things, just because they're natural, are kind of effortless and easy. Yeah? Even if you play the piano or the violin and you do your Paganini Capricci, you know, in effortless mode, it's probably not been effortless to practice them. Yeah. Or for it to look effortless means you have practiced very hard for this. So effort is a crucial ingredient. In fact, if you look at the Buddha's teaching, effort keeps coming in as one of the factors, together with mindfulness and together with clear comprehension. In the Satipatthana Sutta, one of the central teachings of the whole discourse is on the basis of mindfulness, the word sati is never mentioned alone. There are always two other words going with it. One of them is a word for effort. It's called atapi, which means keen or eager. Yeah. Tapas means heat. And atapi means in a heated way. Yeah, sort of, you know, you are quite keen or eager in your application of mindfulness. So effort is on every level in Buddhist teaching, can be found. Virya is on every level, it's in there. Bringing in effort, bringing up energy, counteracting laziness, counteracting stupidity, challenging existing beliefs, inquiring into things I don't understand, bringing about conditions I have not yet realized in my life, trying to, with effort, bring to an end conditions I know are unwholesome. So there's a constant encouragement to apply, to bring in effort, to produce things, to abandon things, to give oneself, give one's heart, one's bodily energies, one's mental energies to a practice. Yeah. Just to be clear, that's a footnote. Let me come back to those Four Noble Truths. For those of you who have never heard them, dukkha is the name of the first one. And dukkha consists of two terms. Du is a prefix, which means generally something like dirty, constricted, and base, or low. Ka, the second part of the word, means space. So it's a space that is base, low, dirty, and constricted. Yeah. That's not the name of your experience. That's the name of the psychological state that ensues in your heart when you make a painful experience. Yeah. It's important to understand that. Dukkha, it's not when you get sick, but dukkha is what sickness does to your mind. Yeah. It's the resulting effect on the space we have been exploring those last 2-3 days now, when we do citta upasana. Dukkha is a condition of the citta. A citta that is afflicted by pain is constricted, it is cramped, and it has degrees of helplessness, lostness, agony, rage in it. Yeah? So this is what is called dukkha. If you translate the word dukkha with suffering, then you would think that most of you probably right now are not suffering terribly bad. You know, it's safe, you're in here, nothing bad happens to you, you've eaten something, you know where you go to sleep. The word suffering in English means more than dukkha can mean. Or the other way around, the word suffering in English is more limited than the word dukkha in Pali language. Pali language, it means that which separates you right now from complete happiness. If you think of yourself as being capable of completely free, completely happy, completely ecstatic with joy, and then you think how you are now, the difference is dukkha. So, if we translate that into a bit more psychological terms, then dukkha is the slightest amount, the slightest degree of discomfort, the slightest degree of unease, the slightest degree of something is lacking, something is wanting, something is not perfect. Yeah, that's the most gentle form. The other end of the spectrum, you have obviously agonizing, unremitting, you know, bone-splittering pain. So dukkha is the whole spectrum of this, the most gentlest form of lack of satisfaction, right down to the most bitter forms of suffering, physical, mental, emotional. So it's important that you bear that in mind when we speak about dukkha, because if you feel, well, the Buddha just speaks about dukkha and actually I don't have any dukkha in my life, I'm quite happy, then, you know, that was it. Buddhism is past you, has nothing to offer you. If you don't acknowledge the degree of unsatisfactoriness that is implicit in your life, then Buddhism doesn't really offer you much, because that it's all, that's what it's all about. By the Buddha's own acknowledgement, this is the only thing he was really teaching, the arising of suffering and the cessation of suffering. So it's crucial that we understand that term correct. Dukkha is universal, dukkha is human, dukkha is personal, dukkha is developmental, dukkha is in the body, is in the mind, dukkha is spiritual, dukkha is in the heart. It can be in all layers. It can be all dimensions of our experience can be afflicted by dukkha. Sometimes the dukkha is, it's not enough. There's good stuff happening in my life, but not enough. Sometimes it can mean, it's too much. Everything is too much. I can't handle it. I can't take it. Too much responsibility, too much pain, too much helplessness, too much anger, too much lust, too much rage, too much nastiness, too much injustice. I can't handle it. Dukkha can take many, many, many forms. Whenever you find something hard, whenever something puts your mind into a space of narrow, constricted, and base qualities, whenever it puts you into a lost, constricted space, then this is dukkha. So what should happen with dukkha according to the Buddhist teaching? According to the Buddhist teaching, dukkha has to be understood. In his first big discourse to the five men who were previously his fellow ascetics, and later left the Buddha. Remember, he gave up fasting and was eating milk rice and received the milk rice from a coward girl. The other five ascetics turned away from him and said, you know, the ascetic Gautama has given in to luxurious living, you know, because he's eating milk rice, received from a woman on top of it. So they turned away and left him. And he was alone on that from that point on. But when he had his awakening experience sometime later, he thought first whom he could teach. And so he thought of his old teachers, and then he recognized his first two teachers were dead. So Udaka Ramaputta and Alara Kalama, they were called, they were dead. So he said, who else could I start to teach? Because what I have found is not easy. It's difficult. It goes against the grain. People won't like it. This has almost stopped him from teaching. And then he thought, maybe the men who were fellow ascetics with me, who were doing the fasting practice with me before they left me, maybe those people could understand. So in his first teaching to these men, he gave them, amongst other things, as is one of the most synoptic and tightly knit discourses of Buddhist teaching, and for some reason I have never quite understood, it's lost and buried somewhere in the depth of one of the big collections of teachings. Nevertheless, it's called the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Sutta on the setting in motion of the wheel of truth, the wheel of the Dhamma that rolls and does not stop anymore. recommend his teaching to your reading on some occasion. So in that discourse, he speaks of the Four Noble Truths, and he speaks of the Four Noble Truths in 12 aspects. So each of the four truths has three aspects. And the first aspect is that there is this truth. Yeah. For the first truth, this sounds idam dukkang arya satchanti. Yeah, there is the noble truth of suffering. And then the interesting part comes in the second aspect. This truth is to be understood. So the word is called pariyayanti. This is something to be understood. So dukkha is not to be abandoned. Dukkha is to be understood. Dukkha is not to be avoided. Dukkha is to be understood. Dukkha is not to be prevented. Dukkha is to be understood. Yeah. The only way you can avoid it, prevent it, and become free of it is to understand it. Now you'll admit that this goes totally against the grain. Yeah? If you have pain, the last thing you want to do is to understand that pain. You want that pain to stop. You want to go away from the pain. You want to turn away. The Buddha asks you to do the opposite. The Buddha asks you to actually turn toward the pain and investigate the pain, understand the pain, rather than run away, rather than distract yourself from it, rather than try by any trick in the book not to feel it. He asks you to feel it and to turn towards it and to understand it. That is the message on the bottle of the First Noble Truth. This dukkha has to be understood. The third aspect of the First Noble Truth is the realization aspect. It's what you say when you're awakened. You say, okay, thank you, understood. Got the point. Yeah. The same holds true for the next three noble truths. The first layer generally is the acknowledgement there is a cause for suffering. Yeah. The cause for suffering, the second noble truth is called tanha, trishna, thirst. Yeah. It's a form of desire. The second layer of that second truth is desire has to be given up. It has to be abandoned. It has to be. After you have understood the nature of desire, you have recognized that this has to be given up. Again, the third aspect is the realization aspect that says, you know, desire has been given up. And the third truth, the truth that says that there is such a thing as a cessation of suffering and a cessation of the pain. The central meaning of the second layer says this third truth has to be realized. It has to be manifested. Yeah? The word is achikataba. It has to be made real. So that's what it says on the bottle. This truth of cessation of suffering has to be realized.
Cessation.
Yeah. The stopping, cessation. Yeah, you got it. For the fourth noble truth, again, the first layer says, you know, there is such a thing as a path leading out of pain, leading out of suffering. That's important to know. It's very hopeful to know that there is such a thing. And then the second, the central message, the appeal, yeah, the imperative part, forgot what imperative was.
Tzivui.
The tzivui part of it says this path has to be practiced. Yeah. So that's what it says on Alice's bottle. Fourth noble truth, to be practiced, to be developed, to be cultivated. So let us have a closer look at the second noble truth. The first says there is suffering. The second says suffering has an origin. Suffering has a cause. Suffering has a reason why it appears. And the third noble truth says suffering can be given up. So the second and the third are very important because they speak about the dynamic of suffering, not just about its existence, but the dynamic. Now let us see what connection the Buddha makes between suffering and thirst. He says there are three types of desire. The first type of desire is desire for experience. We call it, say, sense experience. Remember, six senses in Buddhist teaching. You have everything you can taste, touch, see, smell, hear. These are the five exterior sense bases. So there is desire for things in this realm of the seen, heard, tasted, touched, the smelt. Then there is a desire that goes into the sixth sense, that is anything I can think of, conceive of, calculate, infer, memorize. My desire can have as a focus things of mind. So this is the first layer of desire. We would call that experience. I want to go places, I want to meet people, I want to see fantastic sights, I want to smell nice things, I want to taste wonderful things, I want to touch lovely things, I want to have experience of this body. Yeah? That's very straightforward. We recognize that. There's a desire that goes into the mind. So, strictly speaking, the desire to read a delicate and refined poem in Hebrew language, which I can't do, but I'm sure there are Hebrew poets. In fact, I know there are Hebrew poets. Some of them I have read in translation and appreciate. So the desire to read a poem and the desire to eat a hamburger are both desires. You know, you may say one is more refined than the other, but both of them are basically desires. You know, one is a desire to sink my little white teeth into the hamburger, and the other is the wish to understand the elevated condensation of meaning that comes from a couple of significant terms on a page of printed paper. Both are forms of desire, both are forms of pleasure, both are forms of kama tanha, if I focus my wish to experience them onto it. So this is, I think, very straightforward. It's not difficult to recognize desire in there. There's a second layer of desire which is maybe less familiar. It's what Buddhist psychology calls bhava tanha. It's the desire to become something. And when we have this desire, we are in a position where we say, as things are now, they are not good enough. They're not nice enough, clever enough, spicy enough, delicious enough. As things are right now, this is not good enough. Something is missing. It needs to become more. This is particularly important when we speak of ourselves. We are not good enough. We need to become better. We need to improve. The object of desire in the second layer of tanha is not the sensory world, it is an abstract world. A world in which we have qualities like love, recognition, fame, power, control, appreciation, things like that. Yeah. Now think of it for a moment. How much my energy goes into getting these things? How much of my energy, how much of my desire investment goes into the realm of abstract qualities like recognition, appreciation, control, love, fame, remuneration? Yeah. These are abstract qualities. And yet, you will agree with me that much of our ambition goes into that domain. We want to be seen. We want to be recognized. We want to be rewarded. We want to have control. We want to have competence. We want to have love. We want to have power. So these are not sensory qualities, and they can be very much the object of our desire. So bhavatana is something that preoccupies human beings a lot. It can preoccupy monks and nuns who have no money, or shouldn't have money, actually. You don't need to be a secular businessman to be object or to have desire, bhavatana. You can be a very conceited spiritual practitioner and you want recognition for that. You want power. Or you want control over people. You want that people love you. Everybody should love you. Everybody should admire you. You know, this is a form of desire. You have to recognize that as a very, very pertinent focus of much of human beings' desire. So this layer of tanha, of thirst, is important. If the Buddha says the cause for suffering is bound up with desire, you have to think this second part along. Yeah? It's not just hamburgers, sex, and poems. Yeah, it's also a few other things. The third layer of desire is even more remote and is probably even less known. Buddhist psychology is very clear that the third layer of desire takes the position that as it is too much. The second layer said, as it is not enough. It needs to be improved. It needs to be maximized. Right now I am deficient and I need to have more or better or, yeah. The third layer says the opposite. As it is too much. I want to get rid of something. I have a desire to get rid of something. I want to be losing 10 kilos, for example. Or I want to get rid of my horrible anger. Or I want to get rid of my jealousy. Yeah. It's the desire that is very close to aversion. But, yeah. Aversion is broad spectrum. Desire to get rid of is very specific. That's maybe a difference. Dosa qualities like anger and aversion, these kind of things, they're always non-specific. It's something that triggers them, but once your mind is in aversion, then even the things you like don't taste as good. Yeah. While desire qualities, they're always topic and object specific. If you like carrots, you don't necessarily like cucumbers. Yeah? Your desire doesn't jump from the carrot to the cucumber. But if you're angry with one person, and then another person whom you like comes in, the person whom you like that comes in still notices you're angry. He or she feels that you're angry. So your anger jumps from one to the next person. Your desire doesn't jump from one to the next thing. Yeah? So anger is different. If we speak of the third layer of desire here, we speak of a very specific wish that something disappear, that something stop, that something be gotten rid of, that something is out of your eyes. Yeah. So it's the wish to get rid of something. Can be quite violent, it can be quite harmless. You know, you have an almost empty toothpaste tube, and then you kind of squeeze the last rest out, you know, on your brush. You hold your brush and then you throw it away with great delight. You see, one more ugly thing is cleared out of the way. Yeah. This is a harmless example of vibhava tanha, that's the word for it. Vibhava, yeah. Desire to unbecome, literally. Yeah. Throwing away things can give you very good feelings. Ever done that? Had a big bag, bin liner full of stuff, and you decided, I'm going to fill this with stuff I throw out. I make space here. Yeah. By my private psychology, there's two types of people. One sort wants to hoard, and the other sort wants to throw away things. And generally, they marry each other. So the desire to clear space, for example, yeah, that can be the space on your desktop or the space on your computer or, you know, just kind of making things clean. This is a desire to get rid of things that take the space. You want to go back to the space, to the openness. Or you want to get rid of things that you feel ashamed of. Or you want to get rid of things that you feel are ugly. Or you want to get rid of things that you feel are unjust. Or that are stinking. Yeah, we all have, in some areas of our lives, we have that. You will recognize the profound wish to get rid of something. Is a desire. And it's important that you recognize this as a desire when the Buddha speaks of this being the cause for suffering. We can suffer a lot for not, say, having control over our anger or over our sleepiness, or over our loneliness, or something like that. So we want to get rid of anger, loneliness, sleepiness. Yeah. And this is a desire, a cause for suffering. So if we say suffering, I'd like you to remember two things. One of them, suffering is not the object of something that is painful, but dukkha, suffering, is the state of your mind. Yeah. It's what happens to your mind when a number of things can occur. The Buddha defines dukkha very clearly. He says old age, sickness and death. That's a starter. Yeah. We're going to die, we get old, and we may get sick on the way. So these are objective reasons for suffering. Then dukkha further is being connected with what we don't love. Yeah. Being separated with whom and with what we do love. Not getting what we want. Yeah. Who hasn't been there? Who hasn't experienced not getting what we want? Yeah. Is dukkha, is suffering. And then, in short, the five aspects of all of our experience, the five khandhas, when these five khandhas are connected with grasping. Yeah. Remember last night, Sandhya telling you about upadana, about attachment, grasping, or if you want the intellectual word for attachment or grasping, when it's on the level of mind, then it's called identification. Yeah. On the level of heart, we speak of attachment, we speak of grasping. On the level of mind, we speak about identification. I am this. This is mine. This is identification. Or I am not like this. Thank God she has the problem. I don't have the problem. I am not like this. This is also identification. Yeah? It's negative identification. That's why watching TV sometimes feels good, because we don't have the problems they show us in TV. Even though the message is horrible, thank God, right now I have a cup of coffee, I sit at my table, this is peaceful, I don't have the problems all these people, all these horrible people have in TV. Yeah? Sorry, no compassion tonight, just feeling better that I don't have your problems. Yeah. Oh. So this is identification. Yeah, it's identification in the negative. Not this is mine, but thank God this is not mine. I have nothing to do with this. I am not one of those. These people are other than I am. So if you think of dukkha, think of dukkha being a state of the mind rather than a particular configuration in your objective world. If you think of dukkha and the causes for dukkha, think of desire as this tripartite desire. Desire for the sensory world, yeah, which holds many, many facets of pleasure for us, but also facets of disappointment. And think of the other two layers, the desire to achieve things in the realm of bhava, in the realm, abstract realm, non-sensory realm, like love, power, control, recognition, remuneration, appreciation, fame, things like that. There are plenty of those. And think of the third layer as well. The dukkha that comes from the desire focused on trying to get rid of things that turn out to be more resistant than we wish. Yeah. The Buddha says very clearly that if we want to give up suffering, we need to investigate suffering, and we need to personally, individually, recognize the connection between the specific nature of our suffering with the specific nature of our desire. It's not enough to say, okay, the Buddha and Akinjana also have said, you know, suffering is due to desire, so I know this, I stop suffering. This is not enough. You know, you want to make a connection between the specificity of your suffering, your personal suffering story, with your personal desire story. Yeah? Nobody can do that other than you. Even if I do that for you, if I see a little bit, I can say, hey, what are you doing there? It doesn't help. It may help you a little bit, but really, truly only helps when you acknowledge this and when you are willing to change. Now, when are we willing to change? We're generally willing to change when it hurts. There's no theoretical reason why human beings couldn't learn from happiness, but the practical experience seems to show that people, when they're very happy, they're not very interested in learning. The interest to learn, particularly to investigate difficult things, seems to increase with the amount of pain we experience. Unless we have some degree of suffering, we don't seem to be really interested in liberation. We don't seem to be really interested in finding out about dependent arising, or we don't seem to be interested in cultivating mindfulness, or things like that. So it seems that we need a certain incentive to actually learn and study and practice, and this incentive generally is called pain. Yeah, one form or the other form of pain. So in some strange way, while we wish to be free from suffering, suffering is also that which actually helps us to learn. It's that which focuses our attention on things we need to learn most urgently. Suffering is that which gives us the both the interest and the continued energy to go back to learning. In fact, suffering is even more useful. It shows us in the particularity of the suffering, yeah, the specific nature of our suffering shows us something about the specific nature of our attachments. Yeah. In other words, suffering is your friend. Yeah. Suffering is—it's not good news, but you know, it's if you go to the suffering in your experience, you will have the closest key to the result, to the resolution of that suffering. If you go to the suffering in your practice and in your life, you will find that going to that suffering is very much the key to what helps you with that suffering. This is one of the paradoxes. And the contrary, unfortunately, is also true. If you do not acknowledge suffering, if you deny that you are actually in pain or in experiencing dissatisfaction, frustration, despair, if you manage somehow to convince yourself that this is not happening, either by over-focusing on other aspects of your life, well, many things are possible, work, sex, work is probably the most famous one, or by distracting yourself, yeah? In other words, by rather than over-focusing on a specific aspect, by just a constant array and a constant change of contrasting little stimuli, which help you to not look at the suffering or to not feel the suffering, both strategies are very well documented, then you're in a bad situation. Because you can't actually, through your non-acknowledgement of suffering, you can't actually resolve it. Because you're lacking the key for that suffering. And because you lack the key, you lack the wish to change it. It's like if you're not going to the doctor, you know it hurts, but you don't go to the doctor and you say, or if you go to the doctor, you pretend everything is okay. You know, you feel weak and you're bleeding and you're diarrhea. You know, the doctor comes and you smile and say, yes, everything is fine. Thank you. Just don't get any closer, yeah? The last thing I want is doctors. I have enough problems. So they say, I'm okay. Thank you very much. I don't need your help. Obviously, he can't help. Yeah. This is like having suffering without acknowledging suffering. So from a Buddhist point of view, from a point of view of growth or development, if you acknowledge suffering, then suffering has already begun to change. Because an acknowledged suffering carries inevitably with it the key to the resolution of your suffering. Now, I admit this is not easy. Yeah? Generally, we feel ashamed if we suffer. Yeah? This is something like, bah, it's bad enough that this happens to me. I hope nobody has noticed. Yeah? I don't want to show it in front of my neighbors or my friends or my family or my partner or, you know, my peers. Peers is generally the worst. Yeah? I don't want to show my suffering. So let me pretend I'm not suffering, actually. I'm robotically happy, you know. Everything is fine in my life. This is a way that suffering is compounded. Denial is an unfortunate aspect of the human mind, and this denial in the face of suffering is what stops us actually from finding a way out from suffering. In other words, that's why the First Noble Truth insists that suffering to be resolved needs to be understood. Only the willingness to actually investigate, experience, and understand suffering is giving us the possibility to get out of suffering, to experience not just the second noble truth, but the third noble truth, which says, "Good news! Yeah, there is a way out. Suffering can be abandoned by abandoning the causes of suffering." Yeah. How does that happen? Well, sometimes it happens by not doing anything. Some forms of our suffering stop when we stop doing things. Some forms of suffering, they need specific action. Yeah? Desire is a type of suffering that if we don't do anything about desire, often the suffering connected with desire stops. Yeah? So sometimes it's just enough to not do anything. Remember, there are illnesses that we can't cure. They just get cured by themselves. The body knows how to cure them. The common cold, yeah. I think there is still no honest medicine against the common cold, as far as I know. We can kind of relieve the symptoms a bit, you know, you can swallow a few aspirin and, or clean your nose a bit with something. but basically, the reason for the common cold cannot be cured, yeah. But most people survive a common cold. You know? All you've got to do is just to sniffle a bit a couple of days, clean your nose, stay away from others. Maybe you have a fever, and then after a while the common cold is gone, is over. You know? Nothing needs to be done much. Just bear it, put up with it, don't infect others, and it goes away. In the Greek mythology, there was a big doctor. And he had a deal with death, that if death stood at the foot of the patient was curable, the doctor could cure the patient. And if the death was standing at the head end of the bed, the patient could not be cured. Yeah. So for Buddhist teaching, the prognosis is good. Death stands at the foot end of the patient. Yeah. Suffering, according to Buddha, can be cured. The cure entails action, and this action is the topic of the Fourth Noble Truth. The Fourth Noble Truth speaks in more or less explicit ways about ways how we can abandon the causes for suffering. In other words, it is called Magga, which means path. It's the path leading out of suffering. I've always felt this was slightly exaggerated. I thought this was always a little bit of Buddhist advertisement, because path, that sounds like it's a sort of broad, you know, well-defined, clearly signaled and brightly lit path we can just walk, you know. Noble Eightfold Path. Eight kind of tracks, one side by side. The more accurate translation in some versions of this teaching is not actually the path, but the middle procedure. Yeah. We're not actually speaking of something that is neatly cleared in front of us and brightly lit, but we're speaking of a procedure. It's a pattern of acting rather than a main highway that is lying in front of us. So, what are these elements in there? Well, there are very clear elements, and they basically all need to be cultivated. They need to be strengthened. They need to be, as the Buddhist scriptures say, made much of. Yeah, that's, in other words, they are things we go back and keep going back, and we strengthen them, we stabilize them, we expand them, we develop them, we bring them to fruition. In fact, we bring them finally to completion. completion of the Noble Eightfold Path is identical with understanding the three characteristics of conditioned experience. It is identical with understanding the Four Noble Truths. In other words, it's liberation, complete liberation. If we have understood and cultivated and brought to fruition the Noble Eightfold Path, then this means we've done the job. This is finished. End of project. So what does that Noble Eightfold Path consist? Let me just name it, because we are getting on in time. Let me just name it. It starts with right understanding. Yeah? The term samma can mean both right and it can mean complete. So on the level of practice, it means right. On the level of fruition, it means complete understanding. Again, that's what you say when you're enlightened. Yeah. The understanding is complete. Right understanding is the way we meet the world and we interpret the world. This is different from belief. Although the word ditti can be used for beliefs, right understanding is actually not a belief, but it's a way of choosing a perspective. That's the very first part of this Eightfold Path. The second part is right attitude. It asks us for a right mental attitude. A teaching needs to be applied and it needs to be translated into an attitude. You have probably noticed I have given some hints about meditation technique. But if you have listened to me, you will have heard that I keep coming back to an attitude. Because attitudes are more fundamental than methods. Attitudes are something that help us even if what we experience is not what we like. It's not a trick, but it's a relational quality. So Sammasankappa is a form of right attitude. An attitude that is interested in understanding more deeply, that is interested in harmlessness, that is interested in giving up. Sometimes this is translated as right thought, which is too simple. It's too short. Yeah. It's a right attitude. What next? Right speech. Speech, Vajrasankhara, this is what we think, this is what we write, this is what we generate in terms of discursive thought. And when this thought is put into writing, into blogging, into speaking, yeah, this is speech. It's not just verbal speech, it's, in the meantime, all forms of speech. Even if you do podcasts, it's speech. Yeah. Blogging is speech. Thinking is speech. Yeah. You engage the Vajrasankhara, mental formation of speaking, of forming concepts. The right speech is a crucial aspect of the path. Right action is a crucial aspect of the path. How I actually behave, how I act, what I do, and what I leave. Yeah. Remember, right action is not just the doing bit, it's also the bit I'm not doing. Sometimes I do create karmic activity by not doing things, by not helping, by not caring. Yeah, this is also a form of action. Yeah. Then, right livelihood. Yeah. The practice, part of what leads me out of suffering and attachment to desire and following desire and believing desire, is a commitment that the way I earn my living is from wholesome ways of making money. We would need to talk a little more in detail about that, for which I don't have the breath right now, but that comes into play. So it's not just what you think when you're on retreat, it's basically how you actually earn your income, how you make your living. This is an aspect of right livelihood. Another very crucial aspect, the next one, is called right effort. It's how I'm actually practicing, how I am willing to put in effort. The Buddha speaks very clearly of forms of effort. bringing things into my life that are useful that I have not yet in my life. Trying to bring to an end things that are in my life that are not useful. Protecting the things in my life that are useful that are already there. Yeah, I look after them. And the things that are not useful and that are not in my life, I try to avoid them. Yeah, those are four very simple ways of creating wholesome efforts. And the next one, number 7 in the Eightfold Path, Sammasati, this is what we're practicing here quite a lot of. Yeah? It's the cultivation of being able to be present with things in our lives. The quality of relating to the present now, in terms of my intelligence, in terms of my physical presence, in terms of my emotional, my affective presence. Yeah? Being with the experience of the moment and being able to recall what is wholesome. Being able to sustain my awareness. Yeah? Being able to investigate in what is happening. Yeah? This is all aspect of Sammasati. And the last one is Sammasamadhi, which is something we hopefully also cultivate in this course. Namely, the deepening stillness of mind. Deepening the calm aspect of our mind. We are frantic. We live in a complex world. A world that is probably more crazy than it has ever been. And the amount of craziness we can have is very democratic. Yeah? The amount of distraction we can have is very, very democratic. We don't need to be rich to distract ourselves. 500 years ago, to have a theater, you needed to be a king. Yeah? To have a hunting ground and be able to go hunt, you needed to be pretty high up in the predatory sort of pecking order. Yeah. Nowadays, you can be absolutely poor and still totally distracted because you have electronic media, you have devices, you can 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, just put yourself out of your mind by anything, movies, music, drugs, stimulations of all sorts. So this is a challenge. I believe we are here because that challenge has brought us here in some way. The crazier the world gets, the more strong gets the longing for something that helps us get out of the craziness. So one of the medicines of this time, and I think one of the attractions of Buddhist teaching, is the quality called samadhi, stillness, unification, one-pointedness of mind, and the promise for bliss it holds, the promise for clarity it holds, and the promise for the experience of fullness so many of us long in our lives. Some of us seek that fullness in relationships, some of us seek that fullness in adventure, some of us seek that fullness in meaning, some of us seek that fullness simply in contrasting stimulations, or we seek the fullness at least in intensity. Yeah. And one way to experience fullness is through the experience of samadhi. If your mind can unify, become still, become one, this is a very profoundly transforming experience. And indeed, it makes insight possible. It stills the heart, it makes us less accessible or less prone to anger and desire. But in itself, the stillness gives us something we profoundly long for. You know? People long for a happiness that comes from feeling in one piece. And the more stimulated we are, the more capable of multifarious sensory input we are, the more scattered we also become. This is one of the paradoxes. You know, we long for unification, and to get unification of mind, to get the feeling of a life in one piece, if we stimulate ourselves and distract ourselves, this feels locally, for a moment of the time, good. But in the whole of it, we feel more fragmented, we feel more pulled apart, our lives feel more jagged and disjointed. So in some strange way, the more fragmentation we experience in our everyday lives, the more we long for samadhi, the more we long for a unified, deep experience of being whole. Yeah? This is a paradox. So being able to produce such a quality of mind by the simple exercises we do is profoundly liberating, simply because we don't depend on drugs, we don't depend on life-threatening adventures. This is one of the things that unifies your mind if your life is in danger. Yeah? Rock climbing, 400 meters of air underneath your left foot. You don't think of your unpaid bills. You don't think of unanswered emails. You're very, very focused on whether your next grip is going to hold or not. Yeah? Very unifying. If you survive, great feeling of relief. Great sense of... You're awash in endorphins. You know, it's fantastic. You're full. You're alive. You come back, you're full of juice. Although you're absolutely knackered and tired, you are glowing, you know. You're glowing with energy. Why? Because you feel whole. You feel intact. For a short time. Now, samadhi tries to do exactly this, but just the other way around. Rather than cranking up the volume, intensity of sensory experience, intensity of physical threat, intensity of narcotic or psychotropic drugs, you know, it tries to do the opposite. It says, I'm going to give my attention to any experience, any old, boring, crummy breath I'm going to attend to. Yeah? And if I'm doing that for a while, lo and behold, the mind starts to unify also. The mind starts to become sedate. It starts to become quiet. It starts to become calm. It becomes, in a way, alive I have never anticipated I could become alive when simply breathing in and breathing out. So it does exactly that. It helps us to come to a profound experience of the wholeness in our mind, in our capacity to be here, without life-threatening impact, without psychotropic help, without wild sensory stimulation. So Sama Samadhi is the last step of the Eightfold Path, is a crucial ingredient in the path. Crucial ingredient in the finding of happiness we are so preoccupied with, isn't it? I don't think any other time has been so insistent on finding happiness, you know, on a sort of global scale, and has had so many options, variegated options of stimulation as our time. And yet if you look at us, I don't know, I'm not in a position to judge Israeli society, I don't have the facts and the figures, but if I look at sort of Western European society, they don't on the whole strike me as particularly happy. If I look at the figures for adolescent suicides, consumption of pharmacological products, admission of Switzerland, 40% of people say that they're at least part of the time depressed. Yeah, it doesn't strike me as an overtly happy society, although they have a lot of options. They have more options than the previous generations. How it is here in this country, you have to judge for yourself, but we don't seem to be doing so good on the happiness front as we seem to be doing on the material front, or on the sensory stimulation front, or on the global networking front. Yeah? So maybe there's something to be said for the value of finding stillness in the mind rather than finding satisfaction from stimulating the mind from outside. Yeah. So, four truths. Each truth, three layers. The important layer is the first one, which says there is such a thing as suffering. There is such a thing as a cause of suffering. There is such a thing as a cessation, a stilling, a stopping of suffering. And there is a path leading out of suffering. Second layer, very important, that's what the label says. Remember Alice, remember the bottle. First bottle, it says, understand me. Second bottle, it says, give me up. Third bottle, it says, realize me. Fourth bottle, it says, develop me, cultivate me, bring me into being. When we speak about desire, remember the forms of desire, sensory desire, but not just. The desire for abstract qualities that are so important in our lives, love, recognition, power, strength, admiration, fame, control, such things. And the third layer of desire, which says, all the things I would wish to get rid of, all the things I would wish not to have in my life. Yeah. Good. Let me end here and see whether there are questions. You look a bit quiet, and I'm not sure whether this is gentle consideration or whether this is honest fatigue. So let me end and see. Yep, please.
You say that the second part is to get things I want to get rid of, and there's a desire there to want things to get rid of.
So that's the third aspect of desire. Yeah. The first one is sensory desire. The second one is becoming. Yeah.
And you want to.
And the third
to
one
do
is
something that you don't want to do.
The third one is the wish to be rid of some of the things in your life.
So I want to get rid of that desire, that type of desire.
Yeah, that's kind of like the snake biting its tail, yeah? It's still a snake biting, yeah. 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 I mean, to be honest with you, things are unfortunately a little more complicated, yeah? Desire is generally given bad press in Buddhist teaching, yeah? But then there is also an admission that you need some form of desire to actually practice at all, to have motivation. Mostly the desire that is helpful has a different name. It's called aspiration, or it's called noble effort, or it's called chanda, which is ethically neutral. Yeah. So there is Dhamma chanda, which is kind of the eagerness for understanding the truth, and there is karma chanda, which is the eagerness for sensory gratification, which is poo-pooed. Yeah? In some rare instances, the Buddha even uses the word tanha for the sort of desire that we need to be free of desire. So there is an admission that you need some energy, some volitional energy, and this is being channeled to kind of sublimate or to refine your state of being. In other words, to refine your desire. So I would think you desire to get rid of desire. I would rate that. I would give that at least a B rating, you know, rather than a D rating. Yeah. But it's still a desire. Yeah. I hope I've responded to. Please, Uzi.
Almost at the same line. Where is the borderline between practical need or wish? Like, I had to go to the toilet. It's clear it's not a desire, but then in between this and want to be rich, there's many things. Where is the borderline?
I wish I could tell you. You know, there is such a thing as need, and there is such a thing as greed. And to find out the difference between those two is a challenge, is a big challenge. I wish I could give you a straight answer to this. The truth is, your need to go to the toilet may be more frequent or less frequent than mine. Yeah? So there is not an absolute value that I could postulate. If you follow Buddhist teachings, you will notice it doesn't postulate absolute desires, absolutes. It doesn't really do that much. It doesn't tell you how to live. But it asks you to ascertain the quality of your intentions. That's why Buddhism is a difficult religion. You know, Catholic teachings, for example, just tells you what to believe and what not to believe, what is right and what is wrong. And if in doubt, the Pope is right. Yeah? And I'm sure you could you could tell me a few things about Jewish tradition, you know, which I'm sure you know better than I. But Buddhism keeps asking that you investigate the ethical quality of your intentions, and that you keep investigate the efficiency of your intentions. So if you want to be happy, does the sort of intention you're having, do they make you more happy? Do they make others more happy? Now this question is in some way more difficult than just to tell you straight away, you know, be a good person, and a good person does this. You know, get your daughter married like that, you build your house there, you give 10% of your income to the church or something like that. It would be more easy. That's why Buddhism is a difficult religion. This is its strength and it is its weakness. Yeah? Because it keeps making, it keeps relying on you being able to reflect and consider and look inward. And that is not easy for many people. It's even not easy for people who want to do this, who understand this. So the difference between need and greed, you need to find out by trial and error. Greed hurts. Yeah. What was the story yesterday of Sandhya? Father ignorance, father avidya, mother desire, and baby dukkha. Yeah. If you get baby dukkha, you know, there was somewhere mama greed was involved. Yeah. If you follow needs, then there is a little bit of pain, you know, because going to the toilet means you have to leave your situation and you do something, yeah? But it doesn't generally produce a lot of pain. It's a crude example, admittedly. You know what I mean? If you satisfy a need, this generally keeps you healthy, yeah? Like, say, eating. Because there it is particularly difficult. We have an overt need to feed ourselves, and yet it's difficult to actually just eat as much as you need, and because we enjoy eating, and we eat with other people, and it's enjoyable to eat nice things with other people. And sometimes, I don't know what happens to you, we eat more than we need. Yeah. And to actually find out the balance is high art. But I can't tell you where that is. You know. I can tell you, you look okay. You know. And I can tell you, I should lose a kilo or two. You know, but I can't really tell you how much you should eat. You know. So this is something in your responsibility. Yes, please.
Like what you said right now, and. Also, in general, speak about the right effort, about investigating, about thinking what the right thing to do, or the right, even about your thoughts. What I'm asking is, isn't all that considering and deciding and analyzing, doesn't it take you away from the present moment? Can't it?
Well, you see, the teaching of the Four Noble Truths is not just about meditation, yeah? So if you ask me as a meditation teacher for a formal meditation session, I wouldn't suggest you think too much about the Four Noble Truths, to be honest with you. But you can't just sit on retreat, and if you go and live your life and make decisions, I think it's very good to think about the Four Noble Truths. And the present moment entails from you that you make decisions. And if you have to make decisions, you better make informed decisions. Yeah. So, you know, in many ways, the present moment is an idea, to be honest with you. It's an idea that is knocking around in Advaita teachings and in Eckhart Tolle and in Buddhist Vipassana retreats. The present moment is not a mythical place to go, and if you stay there, you kind of stay at the crest of the wave and everything is hunky-dory. There are any amount of present moments that will need decisions from you. And in those decisions, you need to be intelligent. You need to have reference to your values, to your skills, resources, the needs of the people around you, your own needs. Yeah. So you don't live in a huge sort of bloated now. Yeah? There are some things which you can't find in the present moment. Just to be clear, you can't find causality in a present moment, for example. Causality? Yeah. You know, the present moment doesn't teach you anything about the causal connection between what you have done half an hour ago and what's happening now. Although there is very much. You know, half an hour ago you drank 15 beer and now you kind of fall down the stairs. So there is a causal connection between these two activities. Yeah? But the present moment just is pain, you know. First it's beer, and then it's tumbling down the stairs, and then it's pain, and then it's, you know, emergency unit in your hospital. So there is a connection between these things. If you just stick to the present moment, you don't get that connection. So the present moment is not the solution to everything. The present moment is necessary to come back from the conceptual world, because we keep living in the conceptual world. But, you know, Buddhist teaching is bigger than just be in the present moment and everything is fine. The present moment can be horrible. You know? You can be in agony in the present moment. It's not that you're necessarily happy if you're in the present moment. And you still need to know what to do with agony. Does that make sense?
Yes, a bit, but still. if you analyze every move that you make, if you analyze if it's right or not, doesn't it, you know, takes you away... always takes you away from how can you be in the present moment at this part of the time if you every single thing analyze if it's okay or not, if it's right or not?
Well, one thing is consideration and reflection is not necessarily analysis, yeah? Just to be clear. Analysis is a very useful principle that even Buddhist teachings use for some aspects of the teaching particularly, but it's a very specific form of thinking. You know? It makes little more bits. You know? And the net result of analytical process is always you have more and more bits and less an idea what the bits belong to. But I think your question is, how much thinking need I to do in any one moment? You know?
Yes, for example, he will think... should I go to the bathroom now? Even this little decision, so much consideration, so much thinking about.
Yeah. I have a feeling that this is not really a problem for him. Yeah. You know... You know, if there is pain, if there is pain in your life, the Four Noble Truths teaching suggests you try to acknowledge that there is pain and you try to investigate whether that pain has any connection to desire. Yeah. Obviously, you need to think for this, but that doesn't mean any moment, how painful is this? You know, which type of desire is this? What did Akinjana say? Was this the third layer of the third truth? Or the, you know? You know, obviously, you can make yourself crazy with this, but you have a tool shed, you know, you have a workbench and you have tools. And if there is enough pain, you will remember to pick up the tools and to actually look at the pain. Yeah. But there will be moments where you don't think of suffering or where you don't analyze your present moment, yeah, where you're simply there. There is a coherence in our intelligence, particularly if it's not reflective, if it's not analytical, yeah. You know things. Your mind has a capacity of immediate knowing, not just through abstract analytical processes, but you can actually know whether something is wholesome or not. You can feel it. Yeah. There is a gut-level feeling possible. You don't need to cognitively think all the things I have told to you in those days, any moment, and block up your present moment. In fact, I would prefer if you didn't do that. Yeah. But if there is enough pain, you will think, where does it come from? Was that a useful statement I made, or was that a bad statement? You walk out from a conversation and you leave, you have a good feeling. You walk out from a conversation, you have a bad feeling. you wonder, where does it come from? Does it come from something I said? Does it come from something she said? Yeah. This is useful. Does that make sense? Yeah? Good. Okay, please.
If I understood correctly, if I will move into a cave all by myself and sit there and meditate for years and years and reach a very, very high level of samadhi, I will be truly happy and joyful.
No guarantees.
If I reach a very high level of samadhi, I will be in a very unified place with myself. And this is supposedly what will bring happiness. Or did I miss that? Because I think we need, we're a social animal. We need the world out there. And
if you're in a cave, you need people who feed you in the cave. You don't get to the samadhi, you just get to hunger and then you die. You need social relationships, people who bring you food to the cave. Yeah, it's true. Look, samadhi is a type of happiness. If you have access to this happiness, you will be a lot less dependent on other forms of happiness and other forms of stimulation, other forms of gratification. That's one of the reasons for samadhi. The other reason for samadhi is it makes you very blissful. It gives you very good feeling. It gives you confidence. It gives you stillness. It gives you good humor. Yeah, that's another reason. The third reason, it makes your mind more clear. And because your mind is more clear, you understand better, particularly why you suffer and what you do to contribute to that suffering. But the cave option, I wouldn't recommend that. I know not many people who have really won a lot from caves, to be honest. I have met a few, and I was under the impression generally that they're wrong ones. Yeah. The wrong ones are attracted to caves. Most serious practitioners don't practice in caves, I know of, and they live lives that have something to do with other human beings. So the option is not the cave. That is not the only happiness. There is happiness in relationship, and there is a happiness in non-attaching to things that is a lot more lasting than the happiness that comes from samadhi. Did I tell you that you can only have a limited amount of time in samadhi? You can't stay there forever, even if you're very good at it. So I am told 7 days is the maximum. So, samadhi is conditioned. Yeah, if the conditions fall away, if you have less favorable conditions, your health is waning, or you live in a noisy place, or you have 3 kids, then you can't stay in samadhi all the time. So the option really for happiness from a Buddhist point of view is not samadhi and more samadhi and stay there. The option is use samadhi to understand A, the nature of sense pleasure, B, find the confidence of being able to do something with your mind that makes you locally happy, and C, gain enough clarity to understand how you actually create suffering. That last part is the most famous aspect of Buddhist meditation, finding stillness as an instrument to help you understand more profoundly what you do in the rest of your life. Now, the wisdom that comes from that kind of insight, you can take anywhere. To your job, to your family, to your kids, to your partners, to your busy life. That wisdom is not conditioned anymore. This wisdom is irreversible. Once you know it, you don't lose it. Does that make sense? That doesn't exclude your social life. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here in groups. We would dig little holes and drink nettle soup or so, like Milarepa. Good. Other voices? Yeah, please.
I wanted to ask about intuition and when you do something and without thinking about it, it turns out to be the right thing for you. So is this the thing that we're looking for in meditation, in And like, is this the samadhi actually? Will it be like clearer if we...
This is not samadhi.
Yeah.
This is not, strictly speaking, samadhi, but this sort of thing is more likely to occur when your mind is not preoccupied with thinking. Yeah. So intuition is an indication of deepening of your stillness. You become, in a way, more... Your relationship to mind is less colored by your experience and your memories and the things you know, but it comes from another layer of your mind. So these intuitions you speak of, they become more frequent if you know how to make the mind still. Yeah? So they have a very great place in the teaching. In fact, the wisdom that makes the heart really free is called intuitive wisdom. Yeah? Prajna from meditation is a kind of wisdom that comes from that layer of mind from which the intuitions come.
Yeah. So is this intuition become clear? Like, why do I feel I should go right and not left? You know?
How is it for you?
Does it become... Now it... sometimes it's without a reason. That's why it's intuition. Just go, and you can really explain what brought me here. I was just going to do vipassana, and now it's awareness, and I found out this is the right thing I needed.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I came here with, as I said, okay, vipassana is something I want to try. So I think this is like, it's cosmic.
You see, what we know of ourselves is generally only the surface layer. Yeah. So meditation is something that helps us to go through the choppy part of the waves. It's like, you know, you have water, sea, and the top part is always moving. So we keep, if we just look at it, we keep being fascinated by the glitter of the movement, by the reflections, by the shape, by the size, by the tallness of the moving part. But if you go underneath the surface, there is a lot of space. Many things are happening underneath the surface. But we're fascinated with the surface. We're fixated on the surface. Our attention keeps going to the surface. But if we were actually willing to dive through the surface, disregard the surface of thinking and images, and there's many, many layers of the mind that become alive and that start to speak. Yeah. And out of this, intuition comes. So I'm glad you came. Yeah. Good. Last one. Okay.
You say that we have to acknowledge pain and suffering. And maybe
just if you're in pain and suffering, okay? If you're not.
let's say that I'm not. Okay?
Yeah.
I am, but I'm not. All of us are in suffering. So if I don't acknowledge this, and I sit all the time meditation and samadhi and whatever, so I deny it, that there is suffering around me. So I can feel good and everybody is...
Well, you enjoy the privilege of conditions right now that are helping you to feel good. And then you consider that other people are in pain. You help. You go out. You do something. Yeah. It doesn't mean that because the conditions for them are not good, that you are not having a right to be happy. Yeah. Obviously, you know, there are other aspects than the teaching of samadhi in Buddha's teaching. The Buddha said something about compassion. He said something about helping. He said something about interconnectedness. Yeah. This is part of the teaching. So that's why samadhi alone is not enough. But finding the capacity to still the mind gives you strength. It gives you happiness. It gives you something to charge your batteries. It gives you a better position to find clarity. And
He doesn't know it's true.
Okay? It's a big question, isn't it? How do I relate my personal conditions, my well-being, and my current happiness with the fact that there are people suffering not too far from me? My answer to this, I do not refuse relationship.
It's like family, you know? Sometimes you can come home and you feel okay, but if your kid doesn't feel well, how you approach it and you don't suffer a little, because it's your kid that suffer in front of you. It's very hard not to suffer from it.
If I was your kid, I would hope that you help me. Yeah, that you use your happiness to help me rather than insist on your happiness and say, leave me alone, I'm currently happy. So I am. Yeah. We need to end tonight. Thanks for your patience. I have good news. In the face of all suffering, the kitchen team has prepared something nice for us tonight, and we have a treat awaiting us over in the dining hall. So I would like to invite you all to go over there and see what the kitchen team has prepared, and consider the happiness and the suffering in the light of what you find there.